Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Shepherd Defence Podcast. I'm your host, Ben Vogel, joined here by our team of journalists on the flight deck at the Farnborough International Air Show to discuss what's hot, literally hot, given the recent climate. So it's hello to air editor Tim Martin, fresh from winning the best rotorcraft submission at the Aerospace Media Awards. Hi, Tim.
Thanks, Ben. No, absolutely no need for that. Congratulations. And shame on me in front of the listeners. Thank you.
Shepherd's training and simulation reporter, Norbert Newman. Hi, Norbert.
Hi, Ben.
And last but not least, Harry Lai, the naval guy. It rhymes, Harry.
Good to be here among all the planes and missiles and things that don't float.
So we're recording this about halfway through the Farnborough International Air Show. So our team has had a couple of days to conduct meetings, briefings and attend interviews to gauge what's making an impact at Farnborough. But let me start with you, Tim, on a slightly different topic, because not only are you here at Farnborough, but you were also busy at REAT a few days before the show began. So perhaps you can give us a few thoughts on what you saw there.
Yeah, so REAT actually was my first time being there. Somehow, over working with Shepherd for 5 years, I've managed to miss out. So really good to be there. And in terms of expectations, I think it's exceeded them, and it's considered one of the more popular air shows, and was really interesting to see what kit was on display, as well as hear the jet engines constantly flying overhead. But in terms of news, quite interesting to get some updates from obviously the UK. I guess the main one was on ECRS Mark II. So there's a new tranche of funding for the development of the radar, £2.35 billion. So quite significant. We're expecting the first flight with Typhoon equipped with the radar to happen next year, and then somewhere looking out to about 2030 for the fleet to have it operational. So that was quite interesting. Of course, there was a visit from Tom Cruise on unrelated matters, which grabbed headlines. So
I saw the photo. Well done.
Yeah. So it was, he had that Hollywood winning smile printed on his face throughout the day. So it was good to see that up close. Certainly. But yeah, on other matters, Boeing were talking about the campaign to supply naval aircraft for the carrier, and so it was quite interesting to hear that they had gone through some flight trials in India, so speed tests and heavy load configuration. So they're really pushing hard, and so that's for the Super Hornet, the Block 3, so really pushing hard for that. And given that they've had a setback in Europe with they didn't win anything from Finland or Switzerland, and obviously
F-35's been hoovering up the deals, hasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So this is their next big active campaign. So it was good to hear a little bit more about that, and the prospects on that front. And then beyond that, then there was a briefing from the Swedish Air Force, and we're going to get into that. But there was the chief of the air staff was getting pretty hot and bothered about the NH90, let's say.
That's right, and I've got to tell listeners that story Tim's referring to has been our best performing air story over the last couple of weeks, although there's still a couple of days of Farnborough left. So in terms of Sweden and the NH90, it appears to be, shall we say, a shortage of patience. Is that fair to say on the part
absolutely.
Of Sweden?
Or, you could push the envelope a bit more and say it's potentially on the brink of being prematurely replaced. The chief of the air staff was saying that there's going to be guidance issued on Sweden's helicopter modernization strategy in November, and so the helicopter 14, which is the NH90 fleet, he said is not delivering what it should, and was kind of very critical of NH90. of NH Industries, and obviously, you know, that goes hand in hand with the cancellation of the Norwegian program.
So it's like a bit of a Scandinavian theme going on here.
Yeah, and he confirmed that they'd, since that they'd been in touch with Norway. So obviously, they're, you know, in the loop in terms of operational concerns and difficulties. And so we'll see in November what happens if, you know, if there is a cancellation, or there is a decision to kind of change things. Yeah, confirmation that we are at an air show, absolutely, yeah. There, come November, I think we will hear a little bit more about what if there is going to be a change in strategy when it comes to the ASW mission for Sweden, and whether they do drop the NH90. But yeah, it's certainly very, very interesting.
Is there a danger of a domino effect for even more NH90 operators if Norway and Sweden are developing extremely cold feet about operating it?
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting because you kind of hear both accounts. So those who are positive about it, you've got the likes of Italy and New Zealand who seem to really, really like it. And then, you know, in quick succession, the Scandinavians really seem to be very, very completely at the other end of the spectrum. So, I mean, it's hard to tell. I mean, what I would say is that, you know, there could potentially be, in terms of other competitors doing market analysis, if they're looking at Europe and thinking that, you know, that the bad news for NH Industries means a bit more good news for them, or, you know, hotter prospects, then... And certainly I would imagine that they're keen to increase those market opportunities and take advantage of NH Industries' problems.
Okay. We're at Farnborough. We've got to talk Farnborough with you as well. And you've been extremely busy over the past few days and attending a number of briefings. And I think there have been one or two in terms of rotary wing that have caught your eye.
Yeah, I think probably what was interesting, given, you know, we are in the UK and that the new medium helicopter program is, you know, high on the list of the priorities for the MOD. So that's, of course, a replacement for Puma and some other smaller rotorcraft fleets. And what was interesting was that Leonardo really have a kind of a balancing act to kind of see through if they're going to win. And in terms of production for the AW149, they obviously have an active line currently in Italy, and they've just secured then an order from Poland for, you know, over 30 aircraft. So really, I was asking Alessandro Profumo, the CEO, what would happen with the Italian line, because they've committed to producing the 149 in Yeovil. He did say, came out finally and said that the Italian production line would end if the AW149 is to be is to win NMH. So,
apologies for the interruption. There is an event going on in the flight line with some loud music over over speakers. So we are now in the media centre at Farnborough, just to pick up where we left off with you, Tim, talking about the AW149 and the production process.
Yeah, so it's quite interesting, because if Leonardo win the new medium helicopter acquisition for the UK, then they will move production from Italy to the UK. They'll end the production line of the 149 in Italy, and for the first batch of the Polish AW149, which on 1st of July that agreement was signed, then they're going to be produced in Italy, the first batch, as I say, and then the line will move across to Yeovil. But I mean, I think it's really interesting, because they're obviously betting big on winning the Puma replacement order. And, you know, what might happen if they lose that? You know, they've set up then and expecting, hoping for the best, but, you know, the reality is that they're in a very tough competition with Airbus and the H175, which is potentially going to be produced from Brighton, you know, which is effectively stepping on the toes of Leonardo's, you know, unique selling point, which has always been that we're the only onshore rotorcraft manufacturer in the UK. Well, you know, the play from Airbus is, well, we're pushing in on your you know, we're pushing in on your offer effectively, and
especially with the UK defence industrial strategy emphasising the need to onshore as much manufacturing capability as possible. It's a as you say, it seems like a hell of a gamble.
Yeah, exactly. So it's, you know, it's kind of strong arm tactics almost from Airbus UK. So really interesting. And then beyond that, then you have Blackhawk, you know, which as it looks, it would potentially be produced in Poland. So not entirely sure how that will go down with the MOD, or indeed if it's if it comes to the crunch, whether Lockheed UK could produce it, you know. But as far as I know, that plan, that alternative hasn't been confirmed just yet.
There's no rotary wing manufacturing or assembly that Lockheed have in the UK, is there?
No.
Interesting. Well, it seems to be a big gamble on the part of Leonardo, and it's going to be intriguing to see how that plays out. Decision on NMH is due when, Tim?
Yeah, so I can give you the latest, which is that in May there was a competitive notice handed out, and at the moment the MOD are in the process of shortlisting credible suppliers, and once that happens, then they'll move to ask for more detailed responses from those who are narrowed down. But you would suspect that at the very least, you know, Airbus, Leonardo, and Lockheed Martin will absolutely be in that shortlist.
And I think you've got some news on Turkish Aerospace as well, a rare opportunity on your part to make contact with some pretty senior leadership.
Yeah, so Turkish Aerospace will give a quick update on TFX. So that's the new indigenously built fighter jet, and which was, you know, first unveiled in Paris in 2019. So going back a few years, but they were saying that there'll be a rollout of the aircraft. Sorry, prototype, I should say, fitted with the General Electric's F110 engine. And I suppose what's really interesting about that is obviously Turkey on the CATSA list from the US for buying the S-400 SAM, and then obviously that, you know, threw off the F-35 buy, and obviously then thrown off the entire JSF program altogether. Since then, there's been no contradiction of Turkey saying that the F-110 is going to be integrated on the TFX, and so you're kind of left thinking, well, you know, was the F-35 thing all not smoke and mirrors? Of course, it's very, very important, but more so, is it only related to, you know, the most expensive defense program, and you know, these smaller components are less of an issue for the US. Clearly, that seems to be the case. So, what was also interesting was, I suppose it's been confirmed previously, but got a bit more detail on it, is that there will be an indigenous Turkish engine that goes on the TFX from 2028 onwards. So, in effect, the production versions will have a separate engine. Now, we don't actually know what that will be, but Turkish Aerospace were saying that there's a tender active, and so their subsidiary, TR Motor, have put forward an offer. Again, they didn't mention what the engine is, but that the CEO said that decision for the tender and which engine would go on is expected fairly soon, so we'll find that out fairly shortly.
Okay.
I think what you were saying about the engine, I suppose it poses a bit of an interesting question. Is can you know, we won't sell you the F-35, but I suppose it's an interesting question of how many bits of the F-35 can you buy up until the point of it kind of, like, if it looks like an F-35 and is powered like an F-35 and flies like one. It's a weird question of where you draw the line of, you can have all of these components, but you can't have the jet itself.
And also, will Turkey end up developing an F-35 equivalent aircraft to export to other countries as a competitor to the F-35?
Yeah, exactly. It's really, really interesting. And I think, you know, given what's happening in the world at the moment, then there's, you know, certainly when it comes to Russian air defence systems and so forth, you know, there can't be any kind of give really on these types of things. You wouldn't expect it from the US side, at least.
So TR Motor would be developing a candidate engine for the future Turkish next generation fighter. Is that the only option, or is that going to be the...
So there is another Turkish supplier who have put forward a bid. So the RFP, as I understand it, has received two bids. So yeah, we'll see what happens.
Was it TUSAS, Turkish? Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
We're doing that. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Tim. A very busy few days for you. Extremely busy. You've had very little rest. Safe travels when you do go back to Belfast tonight. Norbert, let's turn to you. This is your first Farnborough, especially as a Shepherd training and simulation reporter. So it's a bit of a target-rich environment. Is that fair to say?
Yes, that is correct. It's my first Farnborough air show, and you know, lots of interesting things, many training and simulation solutions are being exhibited here, but I would point out one element that's very significant is the multi-domain training solutions. The BAE Systems announced that it will deliver a proof of concept of its multi-domain single synthetic training environment solution at the end of this year. They began works at ITEC last April with Hadean, but now numerous other companies are involved in the effort, including Inspire. And Inspire will provide wide force and the human data element of the effort. But I think it's, you know, worth to actually zoom in Inspire and mention them independently, because they are developing their own multi-domain training solution as well. It's in very early stages. It doesn't have a name yet. And the company just did the concept demonstration overview at the show on the second day. And they said we can expect a full concept demonstration in September.
And is this being developed in response to a particular requirement, or entirely internally motivated by Inspire?
Well, the company said that it isn't a response of any direct request from a customer or from any military body, but you know, there are significant overlaps in what they are doing, what Bohemia is doing, and what BAE Systems, who now owns Bohemia. The solution runs on Ascot 7, and that's the main entity generator for the solution, and also uses DBS2, which is BBS4, the full solution. It can generate tactical level operations, and trainees can participate in those scenarios on various devices, right? And with DBS2 now, with the full BBS4 solution, they actually have the whole planet as their platform. They can build training solutions, terrain, whatever they see fit. And everything that happens in that tactical environment is actually sent back to the headquarters so that commanders can review data and have a better view of the tactical level, you know, what happens on the tactical level. So essentially this will feed into C2 and how decision is made on that level.
And when would this see the light of day? When would it actually be used for real?
Well, again, we don't know, since the company said that it's not particularly developing it for anyone yet, but we can see a full concept demonstration in September.
And I think you've also had a look at some hardware as well as software development for training and simulation. You took a buggy up to one of the chalets yesterday and had a quick chat with Aero Vodokody.
Yeah, that is correct. Aero Vodokody signed an MOU with Patriots Global Training, a US training provider, aerospace training provider company. And essentially what this partnership aims to do is to help Aero break into the US military aviation market. Aero already has some US presence with some aircraft and upgrade program delivered for a couple of military training companies, but this MOU aims to meet some of the DoD's requirements. The partners will establish a new regional maintenance and upgrade hub, and they also intend to set up a licensed production for Aero's superstar jet trainer, if we can say that, the L39NG, the next generation. PGT said that they will add certain mission software and mission computing components, so that synthetic training elements, or they will be able to inject those synthetic elements into live training scenarios, and trainees will be able to participate in fifth generation fighter trainer tactics with sensor fusion. The companies didn't give timelines or name any specific US programs that they would bid for. But should the aspiration come to fruition, and should the DoD place a large enough order, Aero would definitely establish a local manufacturing site. But this would not only make sense in logistic, in terms of logistics, but also it would be a requirement under U.S. National security law.
I was going to say, it helped to get around any kind of Buy America politicians in the States if there was a proper U.S. manufacturing presence for Aero for the Cody.
Yes, exactly. That's right.
And so the L39NG is it's used by a number of air forces in elsewhere in the world, but I think a few of them have been procured by private US air training providers.
Yes, that is correct. But regardless, Aero seems to devote most of its efforts to the L39NG. But why wouldn't it, right? Because it's a very successful platform, as you said, across the globe. They've been sold in smaller sizes, right? The most recent customers are Hungary and Vietnam, both countries procuring 12 of the aircraft, and they're to be delivered in the next couple of years. And the L39NGs have been sold to a couple of US training companies. One of them is Draken, and the listeners would have heard about Draken Europe recently, as Aero announced that they will begin to deliver the RAF's Red Air Aggressor Training Service with their L159E Honey Badger aircraft. So those Honey Badgers are being operated by Draken Europe, and the program was actually launched to account for the retirement of the Hawk T1s flown by the RAF 100 Squadron and the Royal Navy 736 Squadron Fleet Air Arm. Draken Europe is a training service provider company that will run the program under a cooperation agreement with the Aero Vodokoli.
Now, there's one thing that I haven't been mentioning so far, and very much the sweating elephant in the room was the weather conditions over the last couple of days. Temperatures of 38 degrees, I believe, Celsius at the air show over the last couple of days have made conditions rather interesting, to say the least. But Harry, you were able to cool off, metaphorically at least, with a new kind of subsonic cruise missile product launch.
Yeah, Rafael's Icebreaker, which unfortunately wasn't a missile-shaped rocket lolly and was actually an actual missile. But it was interesting. New product in some ways, but not actually new in that it's from the same missile as the Seabreaker, which was announced pretty much about a year and a month ago. And they are, for all intents and purposes, the same missile, just launched in different ways. So Icebreaker is air-launched, and Seabreaker, when it was announced, was sea and land launched, hence the name Seabreaker. Not sure where the ice in Icebreaker comes from, but
which we could have seen some over the last couple of days.
Exactly. But it's an interesting new product. It features an EO passive sensor and some interesting artificial intelligence to do automatic target recognition, automatic target acquisition and recognition. It's got a built-in mission planning software, which you can use to kind of identify waypoints that you'd like the missile to fly, potential threats. So if there's a SAM system, you can basically kind of guide the missile to avoid it and improve its survivability. And one of the benefits that Rafael said was its ability to fly incredibly low. So that's over sea or land. Essentially, lots of different ways of increasing the survivability to make sure the missile hits its target.
And what kind of platforms are identified to carry this particular missile, or is it too early to say?
No, so they told me it can be carried on the F-16 and the F-15. In my story, believe off the numbers off the top of my head, was 4 on the F-16 and 7 on the F-15. So on the F-15, that's a pretty sizable package, given each missile carries a 120 kilogram warhead, which is around the same as pretty much most market anti-ship missiles at the moment. So you can imagine that it packs quite a punch, and if you've got seven of them, that do some damage. And Rafael also told me that there was plans to integrate the weapon onto the F-35. So they wouldn't mention specific customers, but I imagine it'd be safe to assume that this weapon will make its way onto Israeli F-35s at some point in the future, given the company and Israel's use of the fighter.
Okay. And one of the big presences at the show, so to speak, is the Tempest Future Combat Air System program, which Tim certainly has been digging into very extensively ever since it was launched. But Harry, you attended a briefing, I believe, with some pretty significant news about the program.
Yes, so a bit of a packed press briefing in the halls of BAE Systems booth. They announced kind of four big updates for Tempest, but the most important was the announcement of a flying demonstrator within 5 years. So that will be a low observable Tempest demonstrator. They kind of didn't give it a specific name, but I suppose Tempest or FCAS demonstrator is the best we can do at the moment, unless we want to call it Tempest X or something and try and coin it ourselves. But that's going to fly within the next 5 years, and development of that will be led by BAE Systems out of the UK. So it's pretty significant, given that the UK kind of hasn't designed and developed a demonstrator aircraft of this kind for quite some time, until kind of the precursor to the Typhoon.
But the UK isn't going it alone. There's quite a number of influential cooperation agreements, either on an industrial level or government-to-government level, to do with Tempest.
Yeah, so as Tim, I'm sure, can speak to, FCAS, Team Tempest, is an international partnership. It's got Italy and Sweden on board. But the most significant announcement from this show and at Farnborough was that Japan had signed up with Italy and the UK for joint concept and analysis. So I mean, it's pretty clear that's kind of Japan inching closer to joining Tempest kind of officially, although this is clearly early steps and no decisions have been made. But the understanding is that Japan, Italy and the UK are going to look at the requirements, the military needs, and how their industrial bases can be coalesced to kind of bring this, give this project a bit more plausibility.
I'll just bring Tim in here, because I know previously you've covered the previous initial steps towards UK and Japanese industrial cooperation, and you were on a visit to BAE Wharton, I believe, recently, where there may have been some information about that.
Yeah, so the big idea previously with Japan was that there's going to be an engine demonstrator between the UK and Japan. So this is kind of, I suppose, building on it, and so it seems that their influence is becoming ever greater, and I mean, all the better, you would say, in terms of if they get the industrial cooperation right, then you know, it'll meet the ambition that you know, Tempest is the MOD at least have always had for Tempest. So very interesting. I mean, also Korean aerospace industries are here, and you know, there's been some kind of talk, speculation on Twitter at least, that, you know, maybe put two and two together, they're here because potentially there's a possible linkage then with Tempest, and certainly there's absolutely nothing official in that. That is purely speculation, and you know, take that with a pinch of salt, like maybe 75% of defense Twitter these days. But you know, that might be something, you know, just to keep an eye on. But yeah, as Harry's kind of explained very well there, that was the big idea, I guess, from the MOD this week, was to showcase the announcement on the demonstrator. And so it's the countdown is pretty much officially on then.
Okay, well, it's certainly clearly not the last that we'll be hearing or writing about this particular program.
Yeah, we'll all mark our diaries for the 18th of July 2027 and hold them to it, because 5 years to build a demonstrator and get it in the air is obviously quite ambitious. So hats off to them if they can do it, especially with the complexities and the technology involved in Tempest.
Well, the official position is that Lanka, which is closely connected to Project Mosquito, the official position, I believe, is that Lanka is still going ahead, even though Project Mosquito is not, which sounds a bit of a form of cognitive dissonance, perhaps. But that's
the work obviously has to continue, to meet the systems approach and so forth. So no, definitely, and the Rapid Capabilities Office are obviously integral to all of that, and they're definitely spearheading developments on that front. And yeah, they're going to keep at it, certainly.
I think one of the interesting things on Mosquito as well is, you know, that the MOD has been talking for quite a long time about how it needs to invest and fail fast, and this is actually an example of them putting that into practice. So obviously, if it doesn't pay off, they'll get the usual criticism, but if it does work, it will show that maybe defence procurement is going in the right direction and that lessons are being learned.
Long overdue lessons being learned. But you, actually, Harry, I believe there's some interesting information coming out of a new kind of supersonic aircraft for quick reaction missions.
Yeah, so I'm sure plenty of our listeners who have got a general interest in aerospace have heard of Boom Supersonic and their Overture kind of new generation supersonic airliner, which is basically a Concorde for the 21st century, I suppose, but far more complex and far more modern. So they've announced a partnership with Northrop Grumman to explore kind of the military benefits of the speed that a large supersonic airliner offers. So the idea is that this aircraft that can carry 80 passengers in a passenger airliner configuration and fly at Mach 1.7 can potentially deliver troops extremely quickly to where they're needed, get cargo very quickly from place to place, or same for medical supplies and potentially casualty evacuation to get injured people over very long distances to a safe hospital very quickly.
So it sounds like an extremely good idea, but I suppose the thought occurs, why hasn't it been done before?
I suppose it's an interesting one, because kind of commercial supersonic flight died after Concorde.
Yeah.
It died with Concorde, and no one's really tried to revive it since, because there's all kinds of problems with noise and people's windows rattling, and I suppose angry people around Heathrow getting annoyed.
The military doesn't care about that.
Yeah, which is fully understandable. You know, you get typhoon sonic booms, but if this was on a regular occasion, like it is with a commercial airliner, people aren't too impressed, and you can understand why. And also, supersonic airliners like Concorde were incredibly expensive. But Boom's aircraft is quieter, cheaper, and it's designed to be operating off 100% sustainable fuel. They've got a net zero focus, is what their CEO and founder was saying at the press conference the other day. So clearly they see military applications and the potential of this. And it's interesting, I think the US Air Force not too long ago started speaking about the idea of using rockets to get supplies very quickly to other places in the world. So maybe a supersonic some kind of cargo or passenger aircraft is a bit more of a feasible option. Obviously, that's just speculation on my part. The two efforts probably aren't related at all, but it seems to make more sense.
Well, it's a glimpse into a brave new world almost. I mean, what do you make of this, Tim?
Yeah, really interesting, I guess. You know, you kind of new player in town as well. Boom Supersonic seemed to be putting on telling a really lively story. And as Harry kind of alluded to there, it's, you know, this reviving supersonic flight is ambitious, I guess, quite a big bet, but yeah, the application would seem to be there, and you know, whether it's dependent on someone, you know, taking a chance on it fairly quickly. I mean, I would imagine costs involved in terms of non-recurring and R&D, you would need to make those back fairly quickly. So you would imagine that there are conversations going on behind the scenes. But yeah, if it's going to happen, you would think that we'll hear contracts announced or for things to be matured, then you know, we might have to hear that fairly quickly. Otherwise, yeah, it could be go the way of, as Harry was saying, go the way of Concord, and we might never hear about these things again.
It's interesting because Boom have contracts from United Airlines for passenger versions, and I think the other thing that's interesting about this as well is, you know, we see it in lots of different industries how the defence sector used to lead the commercial world, and very much commercial developments were derivatives of what was being done in the defence industry. And this is, I suppose, another example of the commercial world being ahead of defence, and defence kind of catching up and realising that people have come up with something and we can actually utilise this rather than how it used to be.
Well, we'll see what happens in the near future. Thank you very much, Harry. And thank you very much, Tim, and also Norbert. Thank you. So that wraps things up for what I hope has been an informative discussion for our panelists and listeners alike. But before we go, I'd like to point everybody towards our special Farnborough Show microsite, sponsored by Airbus. You can see a link at the top of our website, www.shepherdmedia.com/news. All stories are free to view until the end of the month. The Shepherd Defence Podcast was brought to you by Shepherd Studio, featuring myself, Ben Vogel, Harry Lai, Norbert Newman, and Tim Martin. Stay tuned for our next episode in August. But that's all from us for now. Goodbye.